एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
माय नेम इज निश्चल शेट्टी and I'm the founder and CEO of WazirX, which is India's largest crypto exchange.
What do you think of when you hear the word cryptocurrency? I'm guessing you fall into one of the two camps. This word either represents the latest fad or is the future of money in the world. Our guest today, Nishchal Shetty, is firmly in the category of believers, so much so that he founded WazirX as one of the first crypto exchange platforms in India. Listen to Akshay Dutt talk to Nishchal and demystify blockchain, cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. Nishchal is one of the most respected voices in this field in India, and he helps us to take a balanced and long-term perspective towards cryptocurrency beyond the headlines of the latest Bitcoin prices.
I wanted to be a doctor. So biology was what I was focusing on. But for whatever reason, I think in 12th, I did not spend a lot of time studying. I was, you know, more of just loafing around, I think. So I could not get through the medical entrance test and decided that engineering is the second option. And I had sort of an inkling towards computers. So I went towards, I took computer science. And that's how my journey into the whole computer engineering started. So it was just accidental. I think I became an engineer.
Okay. So how were those 4 years in college like?
Right. So the thing is, when I took up engineering, I think I took up computer engineering because I just liked computers. I didn't know much about it. And this was way back in 2007 is when I think, 2003 is when I got into engineering. And those times, it was still early days of internet. I went to a college in Bangalore called NITTE, NITT. This was, you know, the early days. And especially in that, in Bangalore, internet was not really easy to access. So we used to get like that 1 hour in your internet lab where you can... Yeah, computer lab. Got my first desktop in my first year of engineering. Before that, I did not have a desktop at home. So the first year again was more like fun, not being serious. And then second year, what happened is there was this, I still remember, there was this project that you had to do. And you would have an external examiner come in to look at your project. And like every other colleague back then, we downloaded it from the internet and presented it. This is what everyone did. They downloaded the project, they did not work on it, presented it as their own project. So I did the same. and not surprised, the examiner knew what students do. While we got terrible marks, I think the lesson I learned is the examiner pulled us over and said, you know, if you're going to just think about marks in life, you're not going to get anywhere. Think about why is this in the syllabus? Why are you told this so that you can learn? And that I think was a defining moment for me. See, he might not know what he did, but I think it's an amazing thing that he said, because usually what happens, the teacher just shout at you. And he told me the why. Why are you supposed to do this? And he said, it's not the marks. For marks, yeah, you can download and do it. But when you do it, you learn it. So I made it a point that in the second time, I'll build something on my own. So this was the fourth semester where again we had a project. And while my friends, again, all of them around me were downloading, and then this time they were tweaking it so that it's not seen as a copy, I built it from scratch. And I learned a lot. And I was really looking forward to the, you know, the external coming in. This was a new external examiner. Surprisingly, he gave the same marks to everyone, including me. He never saw my project. I think in that moment, it was not marks anymore. It was not about someone seeing the joy. I felt, and the fact I could show, and this, I built a small game in C graphics And the fact that I could talk about it, even today I talk about it. See now I'm talking about it. I think that that moment defined it, saying that it doesn't matter what others think, what external examiners think, but that satisfaction of doing something on your own. I think that I caught on to the bug. Surprisingly, that game was called Bug Attack. It was about a farmer saving his farm from bugs by shooting at them. So yeah, I think that was my defining moment into the world of building products and software. And after that, I've never looked back. In my fourth year of engineering, again, when the final year projects were there, I built it on my own. While this time, my friends had gotten sophisticated. There was a company where you could pay them to build your custom software. the progress people make is amazing. Yeah. But for me, it was just fun after that. My project, it was a team of three. The other two did not do anything. It was just me. And I did not complain. I got them to make the documentation, but I did the coding. So, a win-win for everyone. But yeah, that was fun. And this was, again, tragical because this was a software I built where you could download things from the internet at the night, because in the morning you had these internet download restrictions and you had to pay for them. While from 9 p.m. to 10 a.m., the downloads were free. So I built a desktop app where you could choose what you want to download, and the night it will shut down. And anything, PDF videos, anything you wanted.
Videos?
You just had to bookmark it, and the software would be on your desktop. It would start downloading in the night. So in the morning, I called it Night Loader with a K though. And the surprising thing was, on that very day, our internet in our exam was not working. So I could not demo it, but then the teacher appreciated the fact I built it. And I remember we got one of the highest for that project. But yeah, and I think this is where the learning of, no matter how well prepared you are, things can go wrong, I think. And that's what I'm experiencing in startups as well right now. But I think college played a very crucial part in putting me in that direction of entrepreneurship. So yeah, that was my early day.
Was being in a job as much fun? I mean, you learned to be a software engineer and then you joined a software company. Was that also fun, or did you get bored?
I think it was fun because, though college gives you enough theoretical understanding and you might do all of these, you really, sitting there in the college, you don't know what happens inside a company and how things are done. So I got through campus and by the way, my campus story was also interesting. I was so busy building. I was not learning, and I'm really not a theoretical guy. So I had a couple of back papers. So I was not allowed to sit for any of the campus placement, except this one company where the guy said anyone in the college can sit. So around 800 people sat for it. And they chose only some 5 people, and I was one among them. And that was my only job. If not that, I would not have gotten into a campus job. And this was 2007. As soon as we graduated, the whole downturn had started. So there were a lot of people without jobs. So I was fortunate to get into this. But I think I learned a lot on how companies operate and, how do you work with others? Because you in college, you're just sort of you and your friends, versus here, there's a new set of people you don't really know and you have to work with them. So I think I learned those things in the first 2 years, two and a half years I worked in my first company. More of a corporate job. Still, it was sort of like a startup within that corporate. Like this guy who was running it, like I said, he didn't want to follow the norm of only people without a backlog can sit for interviews. So he said anyone can sit. So he was sort of trying to build something different within that corporate company. So two and a half years, that was fun. After that, obviously that it was a...
What was the product?
It was a product for the recruitment industry where recruiters could... follow the entire, it was an HRM software. And this was the pre-SaaS days. So we had to customize the software for different databases. The installation was where you had to go to the premise and install it for the clients. And that whole thing, the pre-SaaS. So there I learned a lot. Obviously, within corporates, different things don't always work. The division was shut down after, I think, 2 years. So I started looking out for a job. I was still employed in a different project, which was interesting, but not that good. It was, again, a services kind of thing. You had to build for some Sri Lankan government. I was building something, but it was not fun. So I finally happened to write to Burp.com. Burp.com back then was the restaurant review website, default one for India. This was before Zomato or Swiggy or anything happened. And I wrote to them, and I think the founder got back. Then I went to Mumbai to interview. I was in Bangalore in my first job. So I went to Mumbai to interview. I almost missed my flight, I remember, because I think those were one of the first times I traveled by flight alone. And I didn't know that you had to be there like 45 minutes before. So I barely made it. And they had closed the gate. And I told them that please let me in, because otherwise I'll miss my interview. So they made arrangements for me to be alone transported to the plane. So I think that is, again, something, you know, because if I had missed it, maybe I would not have gotten this job into a startup. So I made it, and to the interview, I cleared it. And that's how my journey to the startup began, because this was a startup, a proper startup with people being like, you know, a friend and work kind of a culture, coming shorts, whatever. And founders talking to you, everyone on the same desk, no cabins, like a big area. You just sit and work. So that's where my entry into startup began. But I joined, and that's where I realized that you know, you could have an idea and you can start up. Before that, I did not know how do you build such large company. Because in a corporate, what happens is there are so many layers, there are so many people around you. It just seems impossible that one person can do anything. And then you have a startup with 20, 30 people. Then you realize, okay, small companies can be built. This is how you start. So yeah, that was my entry point. And then around there, because this got acquired, a lot of people, the key people, started you know, slowly they were trying out their own ideas on the site. So that's when I got motivated to try my own small ideas, and I started experimenting during the weekends to build products. And that's where I think I built my first product, which ultimately became Crowdfire. It was more like a weekend thing.
Okay. So you also written 2i5 in your LinkedIn bio as another startup you did around the time
right.
You joined.
So, Verb, you know, that was just a blog. But the early days, what happens is when you, it was a blog that used to review different products built on Twitter. And if I reached out to the founder saying, hey, I'm a guy who's running a blog, they don't get back. But if you reach out to them saying, hey, we, if you, instead of I, you use we, it changes a lot of things. So I used to project this as a startup, though it was a single guy writing a blog and reach out to people. So, but that was just a blog which I maintained. That helped me a lot, though, in understanding what the market wanted. Because when you write blog posts, you get an idea on what is read more, what your audience wants. So that definitely gave me a direction in social networks, what were people looking for. And I realized that people were looking for growth on social media. They wanted to grow. They wanted more followers. That's how I ended up building Crowdfire.
Okay. So tell me about the Crowdfire journey. Like you, what did you originally start it as?
People were looking for growth. And I think before that, the bigger problem there was in the early Twitter days, you could follow as many people as you wanted. And for growing, what people used to do, they used to follow, let's say, 1,000 people, so that 1,000 people get to know about them and maybe 100 people might follow you back. Yeah. And that's how you grow your following. The problem with this was when you follow 1,000 people, your timeline on Twitter gets flooded with unwanted tweets. So then people are then looking to rectify that mistake. And that's where I saw an opportunity, and I built an easy way for people to unfollow people in large numbers. So that's how the first version started, and that became viral. People started sharing it crazy. And I think the first day itself, I saw 5,000 people signing up. And within a few months, I think there were 200,000-300,000 people already. And maybe in 8 months or 9 months, we were close to 800,000 or a million users. And while this was happening, I was still working at Burp, and this was still a weekend project for me. So there was no one else, me alone coding on Saturdays and Sundays or on weekdays after I go back home. About 3 months into this, 3 or 4 months into this weekend project, the number of people using it was so large that I could not afford to pay the server charges. It was expensive and I had not monetized it. So what I decided was I need to pay the server charges. Let's monetize it. So I put a simple paywall saying if you want to unfollow more than 25 people in a day, you had to pay $10, like a one-time fee. And I thought maybe, you know, I'll get a few $100 and pay off the server charges. And the server charges were maybe $200-$300. But yeah, at that time, you're doing a regular job. $200-$300 is a lot of money to pay out of your pocket. So I put this, surprisingly, I think within the first few weeks, I started making way more money than my job was paying my entire year. So that's where I understood the power of the internet. See, what happens is I've seen the offline world. I've seen my dad's restaurant. I've seen the kind number of people who can come, who can pay, how much percentage cut you would make from that. But here you are in the internet world where your expenses, if you're a software developer, is nothing except for your server charges. And the distribution that you get online is mind-blowing. You know, we are just so used to numbers like 100,000 million. But you put that in the offline world perspective, there is no business that can accommodate 100,000 people coming, except for maybe the stadiums, the largest stadiums. No one can. So, you know, we don't get that perspective, but, you know, even if a small percentage of those people pay, that's a ton of money. And that realization happened when I put this paywall. Till then, I never knew that you could make this kind of money. And my blog was not paying me a lot because advertisements don't pay you a lot. Like 10,000 views, you will get $100, $10, $20. So this is where this was the early days of SaaS. SaaS was not such a known term, by the way. Nobody thought that, you know, and my first model was not SaaS. It was a one-time payment. But when I saw that one-time payment, and eventually then you learn, then I converted that to a monthly payment. And that shot up my revenue like crazy.
And you were still in your job?
I think the whole traditional mindset that you need a job. There was nothing else that was keeping me there. And when I told my parents I need to quit, they were also worried. They also, because they saw me in a job, I was happy. They were like, are you sure you want to quit? I told them, yeah, I'm making more money, but I don't think parents really bother so much about how much their kids make compared to, you know, their kids being happy. For the parents, it's more happiness. And I think, yeah, and maybe my stability. Dad coming from a business background understands what it takes. Back then, to be honest, even I did not anticipate the kind of unsettled life that you could lead as an entrepreneur. And no matter how much money you make, the job versus an entrepreneurship, they're really two different mindsets. And, you know, you need to take a choice. There's nothing good or bad. It's this or that. But I just took that dive because I knew that here I'm making enough. If I go wrong also, I can always get back to a job. And I would have saved enough to not worry about my expenses. So I would say in a way, it was more accidental for me to quit my job. I see today, and I don't know if I can do it. I see a lot of people who say I quit my job. I'm trying to figure out the next thing I want to do in my startup. Maybe it's a new generation thing. Maybe because there's more stability in their lives, even otherwise, I think. But back in the day, I had to make sure I was financially secured before I could quit. So that was my journey back then. And that's how the whole startup thing started for me.
Okay. So once you got into it full time, like when did you change the name to Crowdfire? That was not the original name you had,
see,
right?
These are typical mistakes where, you know, when you're building something, you think in the moment and name it. And I was building a tool to unfollow. So I named it just Unfollow. Now that worked well for a year and a half or 2 years, I think. But then I wanted to build more features. And the problem was, no matter how much I built, no one was using anything else apart from the unfollow feature. Because that's the mindset people come with, that it's just unfollow. So I wanted to build a social media management suite, a set of tools for managing all your social networks in a single place.
The way you have the tools today, you have like HubSpot and Hootsuite.
Yeah, so Crowdflare is a direct competitor to Hootsuite and Buffer today. And that is what way back this was. I think we renamed it 2014 or 2015. So yeah, 3-4 years we were running as just Unfollow. So lines are blurred right now. But I think in 2014 we renamed it mostly, or 15. I don't remember.
Okay. And did you bring on a co-founder, or you were like running it alone and you built up a team and all that? Like, you know, how did it progress? Like, first year after quitting, what kind of revenue did you make? What kind of headcount did you have? And then how did that grow?
The first person to join me was about 4 months after I quit. And that was my first co-founder, my tech co-founder, Samir. He was working with me at Burp. So it was easy to, you know, convince him to join me, and he joined me. And then after a year again later, my third co-founder Siddharth joined me. He was running his own startup. Then we realized that together we could build this faster, so he joined. So they joined later, but I gave them the co-founder tie because this was still early days of running the company. So yeah, that's how three of us got together. But our headcount, I think the second year of starting up, when Sami joined me, it was just me and him. The third year, I think we were like 4 or 5 people. We had scaled up to 5 people because we realized a lot of work had to be done. We had the money to. So we bootstrapped this first business to $1 million in revenue without any funding, and about 6 million or 7 million users by 2014 or 2013. The same thing that I started in 2010 as a side project. In 3 years, it had scaled up. And in 2015, we raised our first round of $2.5 million from Kalari Capital. And till then, there was... Then after raising the Series A, we scaled up really fast to about 70, 80 people by 2016 or 2017, I think.
So this Series A was with what objective? To build it into a like a Buffer kind of a platform, like a complete.
Yeah, by the way, Buffer also was not a platform in that time. They were only about scheduling, and they were also trying to navigate towards becoming a suite. Hootsuite was probably that one of those first few who had the vision to be a social media management software right from day one. And it's because of Ryan, who's the founder. He comes from that agency background where they used to do it for the agencies. So I think his background helped him understand what the market wants. Me was accidental. I think Buffer also was sort of, they were accidental guys. They built a scheduling software, which scaled up. So I think this is the difference between first-time entrepreneurs versus people who've done it before. You sort of have a bit more, insights into what the market wants compared to newbies. But that's okay. Everyone has their own pros and cons. So yeah, we built this and we started scaling it up. And we tripled our revenues, I think, to 3 million within a year and a half of raising our first round. So that went really well. But then in 2016, December, I think, Instagram changed the rules of their software, of their APIs. And that's where my first understanding that you're building on top of some other third-party APIs. The problem is when your features clash with their monetization, they're going to get you out of the way. And our biggest features were providing you growth. And if you look at the social networks today, apart from advertisement, one of the best ways for them to make money is by getting you to pay for growing your social network, your profiles on their platform. So people pay for trending hashtags, people pay for gaining followers. They all pay to Instagram, to Facebook, to Twitter. Back in the day, people used to grow organically using our software by paying us just $10 a month. So they started removing these APIs. They started putting out rules saying you can't build these features. And these guys are really smart with narratives. So many of these social networks, they said this is to cut the spam. This is to cut the unwanted usage of our social network. This is all bullshit data. There was no spam. We were helping people to cut out the spam by unfollowing people. There is no spam in unfollowing. And if you do not follow enough people, how do you even know who are the people you need to be following? Who are the people tweeting them? You know, so all of this is all, if you see, it was all crap because they wanted to build their own feed where they can feed you things they want you to see, not what you want to see or not what you should discover. You see the social networks of today, their algorithms are trained to show you what they want you to see, not what you should be seeing or you want to see. It's not designed for that. So this was all the precursor to that, you know, to the world that we are in today, where social networks control what we consume. They control who grows on their networks and who does not. You've seen what has happened. While we may not politically agree, but Trump has been banned today. So, you know, ultimately, I think it was all a very vicious thing that kept happening, and we were collateral damage. Our top features got cut out, and that led to a lot of trouble for us because our revenues took a hit. So we had to downsize the company, and this was for no fault of ours. We were running really well. We were growing 3x every year in revenue. It also gives you an understanding of never to build on top of these centralized companies, because the day they are done with you, they'll cut you off. So I don't recommend anyone to ever do that.
Did Hootsuite and Buffer also go through this period of contraction? And was this only Instagram, or did it happen on multiple platforms? Like the restrictions of third party integrations,
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and everyone has been affected. Hootsuite, for example, used to give you that feed; you could view your timeline on. And I think today you can't do that for few of the social networks. Instagram has also almost cut off a lot of the. You can't do the feed. You can't follow and follow. You can't do that at all. You can't easily reply to direct messages. There's a lot of things that have been cut off. So, but the thing is, for them, what worked is from day one, at least for Buffer, they were more B2B. They were more towards companies. For us, and my DNA is more consumer. I was more about the consumers, which is why we have more users acquired in the last 10 years, which is over 20 million, compared to even Hootsuite or Buffer. No one has close to our user space. So the kind of growth we saw was because we were consumer. We were not B2B. But after this happened, we had to move to B2B. Now we are more B2B.
Okay. Like you were catering more to people who were influencers or wannabe influencers.
It was more about, I was a big champion of the influencer segment. And this was even before influencers were a big thing, like the podcasters, the YouTubers. All of them, by the way, use the users. They've grown a lot of most of the influences of that you see today who've been there for 5-6 years. They've all used Crowdfire to grow, and there's nothing wrong in that, because if they don't put themselves in front of people, how will people discover? There is no other way. You know, no one is magically going to get to know you unless you're a celebrity on television or you're getting covered in the local media. No one will know that you are a good podcaster or a good YouTuber. And the only way to know was for you to reach out to the people on your own. So, but again, you know, what I've seen in all this whole thing is nobody cares about the small guy. It's only where the big money is, where, it's the large companies and everyone builds things around them. The others just have to pick the pieces and adjust themselves to the ecosystem that exists. That's how it is.
Okay. Okay. So Crowdfire is still like a scaled down version of what
it used to be? In terms of feature, it's a scaled up version because we've now got a lot more features. In terms of active user base, it's definitely a smaller number because it's B2B now. You could also use it. A lot of influencers use it. But more than influencers, the revenue model, everything works better for, let's say, agencies, companies, startups, all those.
Okay, and you are like you moved on to your next venture. So you're not like actively
involved in running Cloudflare anymore. No, they're running it. They've been people who've been with us right from like the initial days after. One of them joined us. I think they were all, most of the people are in the top, the first 10 people who joined us back then. So they're running it and they love working on it and growing it. But I was, like I said, my DNA is more consumer. I somehow don't connect with the whole business software. Not yet. I wouldn't say never, but not yet. So I started looking out for what's next. And it was not just consumer. The second was this whole, the reason why I told you about these social networks and their control on the ecosystem of developers is I was looking for what is it that I can build where nobody else controls what I build. And that happened to be crypto. The blockchain ecosystem is one where it's a permissionless distributed ledger. So that permissionless is the thing that attracted me. You don't have to ask anyone to build something on top of this. And which is why I got into this whole ecosystem and said, I'll build something on there.
So give me an elevator pitch of blockchain. Like if you were to convince a VC to fund a blockchain-based business, what would be the elevator pitch for blockchain as a technology? Like, just like a simplified version.
I think, look at the internet. The internet at the very basic level is just a peer-to-peer transfer of information. What you and me are doing right now, it's information flowing between me to you, you to me. And the entire internet that has been built is built on this philosophy of information transfer from peer to peer. Now, the crypto networks, the blockchain, is peer-to-peer transfer of value. Okay? You have to remember and understand this. Peer-to-peer transfer of information created the digital internet age and transformed the world. What happens when this peer-to-peer transfer of value takes over and comes as the second layer on top of this information? Now, you can have hundreds and thousands of applications that will be built on this very concept. I cannot even tell you what can be built because there's like in 1995, I could not tell you you can book a cab and travel. You can survive a pandemic on information transfer. But peer-to-peer value transfer is the underlying concept of everything that is happening in this ecosystem today.
So if I were to use an analogy, so like say earlier, if you wanted to be a video creator, you would have to go through a TV channel. But now you can just upload a video on YouTube and directly reach your audience.
Yeah, it democratized similarly, like information. Right? You know, you're a podcaster, you start your own. You don't have to worry about it. You're on the internet, anyone can access it. You don't need a middleman, right? That's what you needed a middleman for in the broadcasting world.
So, like right now, RBI is, say, a middleman for exchange of value.
Let's go below that RBI. So, why they're doing is they don't have a technology to not be the middleman. The way you see in the offline world, for example, when I have to pay you 100 rupees, I take out a 100 rupee note, give it to you. That's a transaction between me and you. Now, in the internet world, that was not possible till blockchain and Bitcoin was created. Because in the internet world, you have, when you make a transfer, you're actually instructing your bank online to make a transfer to my bank account online. So it's a three-party, four-party, five-party system. But when you send me a Bitcoin from your wallet to mine, it is just between me and you. It's exactly a replica of the cash system online. So now, this is what is the whole magic. And once you understand this magic, no one can tell you that what applications can be built, because if I know it, I'll build it. I would want to be those early movers in this space, but again, I think it will take some time because the infrastructure is being built. It's like the internet did not become the internet till undersea cables were laid all over the world. So it takes some time to build out this infrastructure, which is the stage at which the blockchain world is right now, the infrastructure building stage.
Okay. So like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are one of the use cases of blockchain and possibly currently the most popular use case of blockchain.
So see, the internet has websites, the blockchain has crypto. There's any use cases will have to be built with crypto in the mix. You cannot build it in isolation, because then it becomes like your intranet versus internet. So if you run a network within a company, that's the intranet, right? And that's okay within that company. So if you were to remove crypto, then that becomes an intranet application within your company. You can have blockchain only application within your company or within two companies that trust each other. But if you want a truly permissionless system, crypto has to be there to protect the network. Because why? See, if you have a permissionless system, what's the first thought that comes to your mind? That I can write garbage into it. I can change the data. I can, really do bad things. This is where your cryptocurrency comes in to protect the network. Because it makes it expensive for you to write into it.
Okay. How does it work? Like, what are the nuts and bolts of
it? So let's distill it. Now, a blockchain is nothing but an open database. Think of it as a notebook, which is kept publicly for anyone to come and write. All right. That's the core philosophy. But the problem is, if you do that, anyone will come and write anything. And what is written in this notebook is nothing but the transaction details, saying, let's say, Akshay transferred one Bitcoin to Nishchal. Yes, it's a khata book.
It's okay? Like a khata book. In a way, like.
Now, to protect the network, what was designed is, if you want to write, sure, you can write, but you can only write if you solve a puzzle. A puzzle which is a mathematical equation. Let's take, for example, to simplify, let's say 1 plus 1 equal to 2. So the puzzle will be 1 plus x equal to 2. So you need to find x. Okay. Now, the puzzle is, whoever solves it first can write into the book. Okay. So let's say 1 plus x equal to 2 and I say 1. So I'm the one who solved it first. Now I get the opportunity to write into the book, let's say 10 minutes. And for solving the puzzle, I get rewarded X number of Bitcoins. So when I write into the book, I can also write 5 Bitcoin to myself. So that's where I make money, where my motivation to solve the puzzle comes. And this cycle has continued from the last 10 years. It's a puzzle. Every time you solve it, you write 10 entries. Again, the new puzzle comes in, you solve it. On day one, when this started, the puzzle was simple because the puzzle difficulty increases based on the number of participants. Okay, so on day one, you could solve this puzzle with your simple computer. But as the network grew, today you need a server farm to solve the puzzle. Because the puzzle has gotten that much more difficult.
So one security feature is, of course, that there is a puzzle, but then there is also like a distributed ledger as the other security feature, right?
We spoke about this one book. The problem with this one book is everyone will have to come to that one location. So instead of that, let's replicate this book entry into, let's say, 10,000 books divided all over around the world. Okay, so now there are 10,000 copies of this. But the puzzle is still the same, and whoever solves it writes into their book. Then the others will copy it. Now the thing is, let's say you solve the puzzle and you want to do something malicious. Okay, so you solve the puzzle, you will write a wrong entry. Then what happens? Someone else who also now has a solution to the puzzle can say, no, this guy has written a wrong entry, let me write the right entry. Now the others in the network will go with the right entry. So that reward, which you were supposed to get, but because you put the wrong entry, you lose the reward, the other guy gets the reward. So you're not motivated to put the wrong entry. And this is how you protect the network. This is a beautifully designed, decentralized way. This is so simple on the core, yet no one found it till 2009 when Satoshi made it. But this is all the magic. There's nothing beyond this.
Okay. So, like, in a way, it is built-in incentives for people to, A, maintain the khata book,
exactly.
And B, be
so
honest.
So, dishonesty gets no rewards. Honesty gets you rewards. of today's, I think, 6.25 Bitcoin. So that's about $200,000. So the question is, would you risk that to write a wrong entry where you know the other softwares are not going to take it? And every 10 minutes, that's a reward.
Okay. And because it's so expensive to create a Bitcoin now because of the complexity, therefore the value of Bitcoin has also gone up. Like, why has the value of Bitcoin gone up? Because there is no underlying asset. Like, in currency, you have gold as, like, supposedly an asset, or, like, you know, you have the sovereign backing of currency. But what is the underlying value of
trust
Bitcoin?
In the network is what is valued. On day one, when there were five people in that network, the value was maybe there was no value in 2009, 2010, because there were like 10, 20 people, 30 people. But as more and more people started trusting the network and trusting the blockchain, the value of the cryptocurrency increases. Now you have an ecosystem today of maybe, I don't know, 100 million people who trust Bitcoin. And trust is what drives everything in the world. Trust, if you want to distill trust, is more about acknowledgement. When 70, 80, 90 million people agree on a common, let's say, cryptocurrency, it means they all trust it. You know, like words, I can create any word I want, but only words that are accepted everywhere have meaning. So ultimately, your cryptocurrency is backed by the trust of the people in the network, and that is where the value comes. And because it is limited in number, you can only have 21 million Bitcoin. The price, as the network grows, the price is supposed to increase. Now see, the thing is, while those who do not understand want to say that it's a Ponzi, people are just in it, but there is something that those 70, 80, 90 million people know, that maybe there might be some truth to it. And I'll tell you what it is. You spoke about gold. There is no verifiable method in the world today to estimate how much gold is in circulation. Which is why you often come across scams where, I think one of the latest was in China, where gold, more gold than what they held, was acknowledged. And then they had loans taken on top of that non-existent gold, because you cannot verify. Then recently I saw a news article where some gold was seized, and when they and it was in the CBI or some of under their control, when they opened it, there was not enough gold in that, as again what they thought. It's not verifiable. But when I tell you that there is only going to be 21 million, you can verify that on that Khata book. And that is something that is solid and you cannot change it. So this 70, 80 million people believe a verifiable book record is much more valuable than something that's unverifiable and purely on just assumption. So if you were to store your value, now the question is, would you save it on a verifiable blockchain, or would you trust all your wealth on a non-verifiable asset like gold? Okay. Now you don't have to take that choice. You don't have to make a zero and one. What you can do is you can diversify, which is where, from an investor point of view, the thought process is, if tomorrow gold gets devalued for whatever reason, because maybe we thought the market cap of gold is today around $12 trillion because there's maybe X tons of gold in the market, but maybe there's 2X gold in the market, or maybe that's half of X. You don't know what it is. So this is why you take a hedge against these offline world and say that I also want to put some of my value into Bitcoin. So that's just one thought process that exists.
So these 70, 80 million people who trust Bitcoin are essentially trusting it as an investment option, like a diversification of their investment portfolio option, or is there also other value of Bitcoin, like as a medium of exchange?
So I just told you the currency. I just told you one perspective. See, it's, you know, it's a lot like the internet. The internet to you might be different from the internet. For example, in Venezuela, what is happening is their currency is being devalued.
It's worthless. Basically,
people there found a way to sustain, or to, I would say, contain their wealth and to protect it was to buy Bitcoin. Because if you buy gold, you have physical gold which can be confiscated. You have your currency, it will be devalued. How do you conserve, how do you store your wealth for that time frame when your country is going through a rough waters, or you know it can be seized by a government, is by putting it into Bitcoin and holding that custody with yourself. Because like I said, this is pure cash. You don't have to trust anyone to hold your Bitcoin. So that's one more point of view. The other is, now let's take the India example, where I keep telling that Bitcoin is going to play a very, very important role, is remittances. Today, when you want to bring in money to India from your friends or family sending you dollars, there is a slippage of 7 to 10%. We don't realize, by the way, because the financial system is so inefficient and so smart that the common man does not realize what they're losing. You know, that $100 loses about 7 to 8% by the time it reaches you in INR. Okay?
Okay. Like transfer fees and the currency exchange rate is not favorable. When
everything, currency conversion, banks in between taking charges, everything when it comes to you, it's already lost 7 to 8%. But if it was Bitcoin, your family can just immediately transfer. So one is it's instant. You don't have to wait 2 to 3 days. Second is there is no slippage of value. Now extrapolate that to India, seeing, I think India sees $100-200 billion worth of remittances. That 8% is about $15-20 billion lost to this middlemen who are nothing but the financial systems, that whose only aim is to make money off of it, nothing else. So I think that is a very beautiful use case for India.
So why isn't everyone doing it? And wouldn't this like bankrupt a lot of financial sector players if everyone started to do it?
It's like your, why is not everyone ordering online? There is always an offline world, right? So see, it's not about bankrupting someone. Everyone has their own use cases. Maybe that convenience, maybe that not understanding technology. This is how it is. My parents may not buy online because for them offline. So it's more of that. So the internet world, that is this whole Bitcoin world, is being built for the new generation which does not want to interact with the old world. You know, and there's a lot of new value that will emerge from here. And a lot of people are already doing it. To your question, why is not everyone doing it? A lot of people are doing it. And I believe as the understanding percolates to the rest of the masses in India, they will all start doing this. Now, I'll tell you the other, from a country point of view, why this is important is today, India relies on the US dollar. But that US dollar is now coming back to my same story of I built on top of a third-party API who pulled it off. India today has to listen and agree to what the US says. If India was to run some nuclear test, there will be sanctions. India will be out of the financial system for or get some or the other sanctions imposed. And how are these sanctions imposed? By saying you can't deal with countries that deal with dollar. But if India was to own Bitcoin, no country can put any sanctions on India or tell India what to do and what not. So we are in a very archaic, very old school world of today, saying we are valuing ourselves with the dollar we hold as country. Think about it. The dollar is printed by the US with no backing. There's no gold behind it. It's fiat money. We are indirectly just, I would say, tagging along and helping the dollar grow. We are not growing our economy. We are growing the dollar. You know, I don't see the point of why are we proud of holding $300 billion in our assets. We should own gold, we should own Bitcoin, because these are decentralized assets. So that's where my point of remittances will play a major part in helping India be more self-reliant.
But is Bitcoin safe in India? The government seems to have like a somewhat unfriendly attitude towards Bitcoin. And I think there have been a lot of developments also. If you could just talk about those developments.
Classic, fight or flight response that we humans have inbuilt in us. When you see something you don't understand, you either want to fight it or run away from it. But as slowly, this is the internet, what happened. I used to call it a fraud. And when I was in Tencent, I ordered a a wallet that was a Gucci wallet on eBay, and some fake wallet came to me. And then I was like, the internet is a fraud. And for a few years, I did not use the internet. But, you know, eventually you understand. And today you survive a pandemic with the internet. So the same thing is playing out here. It is going to be that period of time where we are going to see a lot of heartache in the regulatory landscape. Because, first it starts with, oh, it's a threat. Oh, it's going to cause issues. Oh, criminals use it. Though less than 1% criminals would use it. And the criminals who are dumb enough to think that Bitcoin is not traceable. Because cash is a way better system in the offline world than Bitcoin, where everything is on an open ledger. So you wouldn't use that for criminal activities. But yeah, ultimately what happens is this, all these misunderstandings, eventually, I think, when we look back, let's say 3 to 5 years down the line, we'll be like, okay, this was all a small blip where we had to just explain and understand, make countries understand what this is all about. So it's all about spreading the knowledge. And yeah, maybe India might have some issues right now. We had a banking ban in 2018, and we had to go to the Supreme Court. After 2 years, we won it in 2020. But there was that 2 years where India just destroyed an ecosystem. So I really feel sad knowing that our lawmakers and all are seeing in a very different direction. But I wouldn't blame them right now. I like the fact that at least that is happening. See, it's better to do something, even in the wrong direction, rather than just sitting on the sideline. So while this seems to be not the best approach, but I think even if they've started negative, I am confident that with enough dialogue, we'll get it to a situation where we can positively get this regulated. So that as a nation, we don't stay fall behind others in this tech.
Okay. So tell me about the WazirX journey. So around 16, 17, you realize that you don't want to build on top of other properties, like on top of the Facebook-owned properties or Twitter and so on. So then from that to where you are today in your journey in crypto, sure. Like tell me about that.
So yeah, my journey was because this is decentralized. No one can say what to do. But a disclaimer, the government can tell you what to do and what not to do. So while I escaped the private companies out here, the government is setting up, sort of do's and don'ts in the sector, which is okay. It's needed. But ultimately, I think we launched this in 2018 Jan. Now, there's an entire startup understanding here on how to go about, because this was my second time. I knew how to go fast. So the first thing was, I was getting into a market. We were not pioneers. We were not the first crypto exchange. WazirX was not the first crypto exchange. We were probably the last ones in 2018 to launch, because there were many before us. And so then the question is, why build one more crypto exchange? So when I looked around all of these crypto exchanges that existed, I did a simple market research. I didn't have data. So I just looked at their mobile apps on the Play Store. And the top rated app back then in the crypto exchange space in India was at about 3.4 or 3.5 rating. So now you know there's a gap of about 1.5 stars, which is the gap which the market wants someone to fill, which means there is no quality out there. There's nothing which people are happy about. So that was my first decision, that we are going to build another exchange, but we'll make sure that we focus on being the top rated app in the country, which means focusing on quality of your product. The second was, though you did this research, you also need to figure out if the market is ready for it or if the market wants it. So what I did was, instead of directly building the product, I announced that I would build this, and I opened up a sign up page where you could just put your name and your email and sign up, but there was no product built. And this sort of went viral. We got 30,000-40,000 people signing up in a week's time of announcing this. And that's when we frantically said, let's start, and we started building. So you know, it was like a market research for me to understand if there is a need, because I don't want to spend 6 months building something that people don't want. So once I got this understanding from the market, that A, there was a lack of quality. Second, there was a demand. I got to building. And then eventually in March, we launched it. But what I did not stop doing was marketing the product. So I think Jan, we announced it. The whole of Jan and Feb, I was still marketing it.
So you are like a influencer yourself, right? You have like about 84,000 followers on Twitter. So that was your medium of marketing and like generating demand through your own.
Right. So I had this following. It was not this huge. It was less. I don't remember. But 3 years ago, I had this following, initial set of people who, because I used to tweet about decentralization, cryptocurrencies and all. So I built a sort of a following. So that helped me initially push it out and reach the right kind of users. So yeah, but I think that was also a conscious effort. So that was the third part. The third part was because this is a financial sector, it is not regulated, and you have a lot of bad actors as well because there is no regulation. The way that people will trust you is if you come in front of them. So no startup founder in the crypto sector was in front of people back then. So I said, I want to be the face. I want to be in front of people because people will trust people. You know, ultimately, it's not about product, brand, everything. If I meet you in person, I talk to you, I will trust you more than anyone else, any other brand. Which is why people reach out to their friends, their near and dear ones, to get recommendations on what to do, what to buy, where to go. So this was a conscious effort of being in front of people. Even today, I practice that. I'm a very vocal founder. I talk about what we are building. I talk about the ecosystem. And I did that because people are not going to trust their money and their wealth into an unknown entity. Especially now, see, the banking world, what happens is you have licenses as that trust factor. So, you know, a bank is licensed, let's put money. But in our ecosystem, we don't have regulation. Though I've been pushing for regulation, but until that comes, you have to be in front of people. You have to tell them you are there as a founder to help them out. So that was the third thing that drove us to such massive success in the initial days itself. And it's continued ever since. So yeah, that's how we started.
Did you raise funding before launch or like
this was bootstrapped? This was also bootstrapped. Funding as such when we started out, and immediately then the banking ban came in after 3 weeks of launch. So I tell the importance of going to market fast, because if we hadn't launched and there was a banking ban, we might have never launched. So you know, because you're like, then do we need to spend time on uncertain future, or do we check some other sector? So while because we launched, we were there and we said, let's tackle it. And we built, but now again, that became an opportunity. So while these things existed, what I realized after launching was people are really, really lazy when it comes to changing their financial software. You know, you don't change your bank account. Even if someone gives you a more rate of interest, you won't simply change your bank account. So when this banking ban came, there was no way for people to use existing exchanges. And we became the first one to immediately build a solution where we built a peer-to-peer way for people to buy and sell crypto. So we were not the banking. We were not getting your deposits. You could directly transfer the money from your bank account to the seller, which is one more person somewhere in India. And that person would transfer the crypto to you. And what happened is everyone flocked from the other exchanges which would not process their deposits and withdrawals to us. So this we sweeped in. We made adversity into an opportunity. And we could do it because we were new. You know, there was no baggage. There was not like 100,000 million people using us. So we could quickly change. Today, I'm afraid, I don't know. We'll have to anticipate and start building really fast, because once you reach a stage, it's very hard to build new software because there are so many edge cases that can happen. So you have to build it, test it, retest it, and then launch it. But back then, we took advantage of being new to drive the market towards us.
Okay, that's amazing. So originally, what was it like? Like somebody would pay WazirX, and then WazirX would further buy the bitcoins from the open market. No, that was how you launched us.
When you say originally, you mean before the ban? Yeah. So before the ban,
which
is even today, we are a simple platform where let's say Akshay has a bitcoin to sell, and Nischal has X rupees to buy that Bitcoin. So you will put a sell order and I will put a buy order. If the rates match, it will automatically execute. And the INR will transfer from Nischal's account to your account, and from your Bitcoin will transfer to Nischal's. All of this within BuzzyNext. It's happening within BuzzyNext. So we do this automatically for you. So that's how the system was.
And this INR transfer would happen from right bank now, to bank? From Akshay's bank, it will go to WazirX's bank, and then from WazirX's bank.
But now when the bank ban happened, we did not have a bank account. So what we did is we said when Nischal is selling a Bitcoin, we can custody the Bitcoin as an exchange because there was no law on that. So we would lock Nischal's Bitcoin. And then we will ask Akshay to send the money directly to Nischal's bank account. And once Nischal gets it, he will say yes to WazirX. So WazirX will transfer the Bitcoin to Akshay's WazirX wallet. So we were the first in India to build that. And with the banking ban, this was the only way where you can transact in buying and selling cryptocurrency.
And how are you earning from this? Like you would charge a percentage as commission?
We kept it free because this is the entry and the exit point. But once you buy Bitcoin, what happens is you can then trade it for other cryptocurrency. So you can sell your Bitcoin to buy Ethereum. And that's a crypto-to-crypto transaction only. So that used to happen on our exchange. And there we used to charge you. We still charge you anywhere from 0.2% to 0.1% of your total transaction.
Okay. And that you will earn in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
your
then,
revenue
back,
is in Bitcoin.
Back then it was Bitcoin. Now because INR has opened up, now we charge in INR.
Okay. So you also underwent an acquisition. Tell me about that. And okay, before we come to that, what is behind the name WazirX?
I've been fascinated with chess for a long time, and I was just trying to figure out a way to provide. See, this is trading, and trading, what happens is you need to make the best moves to make money in the market. And in chess, the queen piece is one that can make all the moves. So that was the idea behind the name Wazir. And X is for exchange. So we want to provide you that software, which is like the queen piece of chess. So you can make whatever moves you want and win.
Okay, nice. And yeah, tell me about the acquisition.
So this was 2019 and banking ban was still in effect. And the crypto ecosystem in India was not able to grow as such. And there was this company called Binance, which has been growing really rapidly globally.
They're
a distributed company. They don't have any headquarters. They've been distributed right from day one. And I think it's the nature of crypto and the nature of regulation that has forced them to be a distributed company from day one. So they don't have any headquarters as such. So when I looked at their growth, and when I looked at the Indian ecosystem, I'm probably one of those top guys right now in India in the crypto space, which means I'm limited by in finding the right mentors, the right kind of people who will help me, because this is a new technology. Not enough expertise has been built on this. So I found it necessary to find someone. And see, my objective always, more than anything, is how do I keep growing more than what I grew last year? That's the single focus I always have personally as well. My goal is to do better than what I did last year. I'm not competing with others. I'm not seeing, oh, this guy did that much. But at times I read articles about, 25-year-olds becoming billionaires, and I say, what a failure I am. But ultimately, I think, that's just a temporary thing. Then I forget. I think each one of us has to better ourselves. That's the best thing that we could do to ourselves. So when I looked at 2019, I said I need to grow faster, and I could not see enough mentor expertise or anything in the country. And Binance happened to be that company, so I reached out to them. Or I think they reached out, I don't know, something happened. But I was looking for funds first, because you obviously need capital. And when I started talking to them, I realized I could take their money. But then that money I could raise from anyone. Anyone could have, usually second time don't have such a hard raising money or an idea that works. But when I started talking to them, I realized the insights, the kind of company they're building, the growth they've been able to achieve. I will never get that with just the money. So I put it to them that, instead of just funding us, I think you guys should acquire us. And then the, direction went in that direction. And that's how we got this deal done. And I think it's worked beautifully. We've grown over 10x after we got acquired because I've been able to learn from them. And there's a lot to learn. The exposure they have globally in the crypto ecosystem and the way they work. It's a company which has grown from $0 to $1 billion in 2 years. And I'm talking about $1 billion in revenue. I'm not talking about some valuation that few VCs place on a company. This is hard money that they made in just 2 years. When we were getting acquired, I think they were around 400, 500 people. Today, they're 1,200 or 1,300 people in just one and a half years.
And yes, this is like a pure distributed company.
By the way, in the market, they are the ones who deliver and who are faster than every other startup, even now. So the way they work, they're even not just distributed, they are decentralized internally. And that learning is amazing. They don't have to wait for orders. They take their decisions. Teams take their decisions. They move ahead. It's beautifully built. I mean, you have to be inside to learn and apply to your own company, which is what I've been doing. And I think I'm glad I would pay whatever money I would out here. I took the money, but I think I would pay money to, experience and know how such rapid scaling works. It's crazy.
So what is your likely top line going to be this year?
I can't disclose that, but I think if you do the math, like for example, last month in Jan, and this is public data I'm telling, we made $1 billion in trading volume. So, and our fees is from 0.1 to 0.2%. So you can just do some maths, you'll understand. But yeah, last month was really amazing. We've grown really fast. And I think this is still the initial days of the market. Again, there is a lot of, I would say, uncertainty because it's not regulated. There's this bill looming on everyone's head saying India will ban crypto. So there's that. I might be calm, but there's a storm brewing behind us. So, I think, but that's entrepreneurship. You can't do anything. Right. You have to accept it. You can't fight it.
Okay. So my last set of questions, and these are questions which are coming from me personally. I hesitate to put money in Bitcoin because every time I think I should, then I think, wow, this is the current price. And oh, it used to be this last year and it's like 2x of last year. And I think it's too expensive now. So, what do you think about that? And I'm sure a lot of people would be feeling this way. It's overpriced now. I should have bought it last year. Now there's no use.
It's overpriced if you're looking at short term gains and may not be a good idea, definitely. Because in the short term, what happens with Bitcoin is the market does not know how to price it. It's just so difficult. You have never had an asset which is globally so accessible. Like even gold and all, it's been there for so many years and it's already reached so many people. But here, there is Bitcoin, which suddenly what happens is, for all you know, tomorrow someone might, like Elon Musk changes bio to bash Bitcoin. And suddenly 41 million people got to know about it. Now, if he changes bio to gold, everyone would be like, we know gold. So it's in that price discovery range because new people are coming in large numbers. So the short-term fluctuations cannot be predicted. But I'll give you data of the last 10 years. So what has happened to Bitcoin in the last 10 years is in a three or four-year period, no one has ever lost money, which means if you buy Bitcoin today and you keep it for 3 to 4 years, you not only have you not lost money, you have also gained more than any other investment. So let's take the example of 2017, when this question that you're asking today. In 2017, everyone was asking, the peak was around $20,000. The worst time to buy Bitcoin in 2017 was $20,000. In 3 years today, it crossed $40,000, right? Now, tell me an investment that would have doubled your money in 3 years. That's the worst that could have happened. The worst that happened to people in 2017, if they just forgot about it for 3 to 4 years, is they doubled their money. Okay, having said all of this, don't put all of your money, because ultimately this is a new technology. Okay, and you know, history shows you that technology really evolves rapidly. It does not care about what exists. It always disrupts. So we don't know what will happen, but I believe that Bitcoin has been around for 10 years, has shown a strong, I would say, willingness to be ingrained into people's lives. So maybe that is going to remain the same and keep growing. But yeah, that's a disclaimer I would like to put. Be just put what you think is a good way to diversify your investment. Don't go all in. Unless, again, risk capital. You want to go all in, you go all in.
So, did you become a crypto believer after listening to Nishchal? If yes, then download the WazirX app and put in some money in Bitcoins. Trust us, your grandkids will thank you for it.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.